Accession number 26560, Reel 7.
Mr. Nickel, Reel 7. We're talking about when you'd moved back to the Koang Sang area. We're not quite sure when. Well, it was a spring. We'll look it up later. And what about the new positions? Was anything much different? I mean, you've told us about the rain, but what happened, you know, with settling
well,
in?
Well, the hill where we were, there were more trees, which made it better that we could build a better gum pit, because we could build the roof out of tree trunks.
Well, tell us how you build this one. Describe it for us.
Well, we dug a hole, and I'm guessing when I say perhaps 4 feet, this would be 9 feet wide by about eight. You cut the front out to give your gun an arc of fire, and then you usually build up the walls with sandbags, probably two or three wide, so you got headroom, and then you had to find something suitable that would go on the roof, and hopefully that would stop a mortar shell. As I say, we were fortunate in we'd gone onto a hill and there was quite a lot of young trees, straight trees. So we were able to sort of cut these and put across the roof. And then we used to steal a sheet from the Americans if we could, which is a waterproof sheet, put over the logs. Excuse me, keep the water out. And then the idea would put a layer of sandbags, filled sandbags on top of that, and then pile earth on, and then not making it too much, too obvious, and then sort of camouflage that, you see. And then you'd build a platform inside for the gun, for the tripod to stand on, so that the gun was poking through this aperture. You made it as homely as possible, you know, really. I suppose that's...
How would you make it homely, though?
Well, you'd put things up like a calendar, pin-up girls, you'd have your dial sight light usually to the right of the gun opening. I had a bicycle lamp, which I blanked off, and I cut a slit in that, so that all you could see in the night was like a slit, a thin slit of about an inch of light, which you put arrowed the dial sight on. You kept it clean. You had to store so much ammunition in there. Leading from that, there would be a slit trench back towards our living quarters.
Can you describe your living quarters there? You know?
Right, a hole in the ground. Again, covered with the roof with what you could find. Bearing in mind that if any shells were coming in, you were going to be in the gun pit, which is the safest place anyway. So as long as you could keep it waterproof, that was about okay. You know, again, if you could get some wood on first, and then a sheet to keep the wet out, and then you could pile soil on top. It would blend in very quickly, you know, the sandy soil would blend in very quickly. Two of us, my number one and I, slept there, and we had bunks made out of barbed wire pickets. Now, they were a stake that used to knock in the ground to put the barbed wire around. And we used to use these pickets in the shape of a bed. And then the empty machine gun belts we used to loop round and then weave So you had like a, well, a bit like a tied hammock, you know. That's what we slept on, you know, which was quite comfortable. Yeah, quite comfortable. In there you'd keep your food and your personal kit, your letterbox with all your letters in, either ingoing or incoming or outgoing, you know. You keep your stuff in there, your photograph on a little wooden cabinet if you could sort of make one, and or on top of an ammunition box. You try and make it as near to home as possible. Candles. That was, excuse me, that was our only source of light, candles at night. We didn't have any fancy electric bulbs or anything, we just had candles. So at night, when it got dark, you used to try and go to sleep, you know, because you're going to have to do a guard, so night time didn't sort of restrict you in any way. You used to go to bed early, you know, so...
Now, were you under much fire, or were you doing much firing from these new summer positions?
We would do it. We did quite a lot of firing in support of patrols.
Now, one of these is the patrol we've got an interest in, because we've interviewed so many people on it. It's not more important than any other, but it's the patrol where Wormald was killed and Bob Guest taken prisoner, and Tony Towle was out there looking for them.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember this patrol as such?
Yeah.
Tell us about what you remember it.
Well, I remember that the Assault Pioneers were going to do a patrol. We knew the area in which they were going, and we'd sort of lined our guns up in that area. And I suppose we had about three or four targets in that area that we could sort of put the dial sight on. And we heard them actually get hit, and all hell broke loose. We were called to fire a little while after this all happened because they were trying to get out. So we were, excuse me, we were firing over their heads to try and, you know, put out the Chinese.
Now, who told you to fire? Did you get orders on
the wire? This came from battalion headquarters through the platoon officer down to the sergeant on radio, and you know, away we went, you know. All six guns, all the whole platoon guns, you know, fired all night. I think my gun actually fired 26,000 rounds. Yeah. And I know it sounds stupid, but my feet were so hot, and I'd got boots on, because obviously the empty cartridges have got somewhere to fall out the bottom of the gun, and the number two keeps swiping them off because he's working. And they were on the floor, and honestly, they were... up round our ankles, you know. It was, we burnt out one barrel. We fitted a new barrel in the gun that night.
How did you do that? Tell me.
Well, you obviously stop firing, and you actually take the gun apart, and you actually withdraw the barrel.
How did you know it had gone? I mean,
well, from the sergeant, because he'd say. He'd know within a little how long that gun had been firing, how many rounds it threw, had been through it, and he sort of could calculate roughly, change barrels. And this order came out, and I changed the barrel. We fired again for a little time, then I had a separated round. That's when the separated case, and that's when the case of the round part splits in the breech. Excuse me. Well, although we had a withdrawing tool, I couldn't get it out. So that was getting towards sort of just after daylight, and that was my lot then, you know, I had to stop firing.
And this obviously done some good, I presume.
Well, some of the guys that got back off the patrol said yes. They said they never heard anything like it, you know, and we came six guns coming down into sort of the area where they thought the Chinese would back off to, you know. It's hard to say whether we killed any or not, you know, I don't know. Nobody went out to check.
It's tiring, you know, firing for that long.
Well, it is a bit, because, you see, on normal firing, you have to time your bursts. So you're counting all the time. And it's something you do in training, it's something you do all the rest of your time firing a machine gun, you know. In for four, out for eight sort of thing. And so you're concentrating. Yes, it is tiring, I suppose, really. But I think the adrenaline's flowing and, you know, you want to keep the gun going and you know there's problems sort of out there and it's what you're trying to do sort of thing.
And was that the most you fired?
It's the longest shoot we ever had, yeah. I think I can say that for all the machine guns, yeah.
And was there other shoots comparable, but not quite?
No, there was nothing compared with that, you know. I mean, we fired, it seemed, for hours and hours and hours. We just didn't stop. The gun ran out of water. We ran out of water on the section. We had a Centurion tank parked on a hill behind us, and one of our lads ran back there and woke them up, or said to the guard, "You got any water?" And he said, "Yeah," and he brought two cans of water back to keep us going. You know, it was that critical, really. And we never dreamt that we'd need as much water as we did. You had what you had. You see, you had the gun ran in a cylinder of water, and obviously as it got hot, it expanded. And you had a tube from there into a 2-gallon can, which had some water in it, and it condensed back into water, you know. And the water in the can was boiling, the gun was boiling, you know, in a heck of a state. But we kept going, and that was, you know, it was good, you know.
Until it split round.
And just after then, fortunately, they called us, you know, they said cease firing, and we stopped.
Now, we only asked. I mean, you've mentioned John Denny before quite a bit, but I mean, I just wondered whether you had any opinion to the way he was performing in Korea, or whether you saw much of him. I know he wasn't your.
We saw quite a bit of him in the Samichon, because if they came back to go to either headquarter company or down to the road, we were quite near the road. They used to come past our position, and so he would always call in, you know, and that. But everyone knew John was efficient, you know, nobody ever questioned that, and he was, in a way I'm glad I wasn't in his section, but he was very efficient. Well, he was a bit exact, to be honest with you. John, you had to be more than right with John. Having said that, I admired him and liked him very much, but our guy was a bit more easygoing.
So it was just a slightly easier life?
With Under Dockery, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Doc was, well, he liked to drink, and he was a pretty relaxed guy, you know. If everything was going all right, you know, he'd have a drink, and that was that, you know.
Would that mean that Denny's section might have been marginally more efficient?
No, I was going to say, even though Doc was easygoing, no, we you know, he knew what he was doing.
So they were both
He was good at what he did, yeah.
They were both very efficient sergeants.
Different personalities.
Different methods.
Yeah. Doc was easygoing, and I think perhaps John Denny wasn't so easygoing.
And what about Hamilton? How did he compare to these two?
Who? Warner.
Warner, wrong name.
Yeah, Warner.
How did he compare?
I don't honestly know. I think he was a bit more serious, and perhaps a bit more remote than Dockery or John Denny.
Was his section as good, or was he?
Oh,
as
yeah,
good?
I wouldn't question his section.
So another method.
Different personality.
So
you know.
Were lucky in the sense that all, as far as you were concerned, all three of your sergeants were excellent, one way or another. You know,
they were all different, but they were all good at what they did. Yeah, they were all good section sergeants. When it came to the time to fire machine guns, there was a lot of competitiveness with this, you know. Your gun was slow last night, sort of thing, you know. You didn't run your barrel in quite as much as you should, you know. If you weren't getting off, they thought if your gun was going bump 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 bump, you know, and theirs was going bump 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 bump, you know, they'd say you didn't work it, because they had, in the barrel, I'll get back to this, you had an asbestos wrap, and I forget now the length, there was a certain length you had to get in this groove, and you had to knock it and tie it and rock it, and then you got it in the gun and you had to work it and work it and work it, and you had a spring balance that you actually weighed it, you see. And if you were a bit on the heavy side, your gun fired a little bit slower, you see. Things like that. But, no, everyone backed everyone else, you know, really. It was a damn good platoon.
Now, anything else, any other instance you recall from this period? I mean, that's you firing, but were you getting much back in terms of machine
gun? Didn't there was a
not necessarily then, but at other times, you know, was there much more to fire? And
no, not really. I mean, there was a what we called an SP gun, which was a self-propelled gun the Chinese used. We think they used to wheel it through a big hole in the hill, and then they sort of open this camouflage or whatever, and they'd fire about three rounds quick, and boom, 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 you know, and then they close. Oh, we never could find them. But that could happen during the day, and they used to do this quite often. But
and did much land near you, or were you lucky?
Usually, I've got my head down. No, not really.
Were there any times in this that you had sort of mortar fire or shell fire concentrated on you? You know, your position, or were you lucky?
We were very lucky. But we were once on a hill. Now, I can't sort of remember why this was. We were once on a hill called 210. And we got on this hill. This was C Company. We supported C Company. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it must have been fairly summery weather, so I'm not really sure. And 355 came under attack that night, badly under attack, and 355 overlooked us. You know, we were only 210 metres against 355, you know, so we, if you like, stuck right underneath it. And that night, I mean, we got there and they said, dig in. Well, you can't make a gun pit in that time, so you tended to sort of make space for the gun and then dug a hole in the side of the slit trench for yourself, you know. And we came under fire that night, shelled. Most of them went over the top and landed just the other side, but that was quite heavy. That night the Chinese attacked 355 and they came across our valley, and it was just like the rice was changing colour as it went across, you know. There were that many of them, you know. It's a fantastic sight, really.
And did you open up on them?
Yes, yeah. My gun actually didn't, because we were on the other side of the hill, but, you know, we were sort of covering the other entrance. And
the machine guns are just not yours?
Yeah, and the company did. They stood, well, everyone was stood to all night, you know. And the man in charge of C Company then was Major Holden. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Well, what did you think of him?
Because we lovely, have heard quite lovely a bit. Man, lovely man.
In what way, though? What was so good about
him? He was very fatherly. I don't know if he'd come up through the ranks. I don't perhaps think so, but he was very fatherly. He was very knowledgeable. And for instance, that night I crept across to look on the other side of this hill, so I was looking at 355, and he was up in a trench, and he said, get in here, and we had a long talk, you know, and he was very interesting, yeah. But he was like that, he would sort of have a conversation with anyone, you know.
Was he, I mean, you know, fatherly can mean nice, but was he efficient with it?
Oh, yeah, he was a good company commander. Yeah, I mean, he was just a kind man, you know, but you've got to bear in mind that 85% of all the platoons were national servicemen, green, you know, weren't old hardened regulars, you know.
I know you were. How did the National Servicemen, you think, perform?
Against the regulars?
Yeah, against any standard you like. I mean, what did you think they did? How well did you think you did?
Well, I'm 71 now. And if I had to go into action, and the people I were with were still the same age, I'd want them. Because, yeah, they were all right. They were good.
And they compared well to the regulars, then?
Well, I've got to say this. Most of the regulars that were any good were NCOs. The regulars that were privates were usually bums, to be honest with you. Not all of them, but most of them were bums. You know, they'd either been up and got knocked down and they were waiting to get out, or they weren't what you call really good soldiers. They knew all the answers. As I say, we were green. They viewed us as sort of Johnny-come-lately, if you like, you know, a bit. They didn't want to be there. Well, we didn't, but we knew we got a job to do, and that was it. You know, we did as we were told. They didn't always, you know. They were better skivers than us, you know. They knew the ropes, you know. So, in comparison, as I say, the good ones were usually NCOs. And the others weren't so good. I think that's perhaps fair to say. Not all of them, anyway.
Any other officers or any other characters that stand out for you, you know, during that? I mean, I'm talking about in career, really, now.
Well, we had... When Captain Haycroft left... No, I think he must have come up for demob. And this would be while we were in the winter position. We had a young lieutenant assigned to us called Mark Gretton. Now, Mark came from somewhere in Suffolk, and Mark was our platoon commander, more or less right through to when we came out of Korea.
Now, what was he like?
Well, he was a blonde, baby-faced lad who didn't know machine guns, who didn't try to know machine guns, felt his way, everyone liked him, smashing bloke. You know, he didn't sort of come and say, you're going to do as I tell, because he didn't know, you know, he didn't know machine guns, he didn't know the drill or anything, you know. But he was a really good officer, and I believe he's dead, but I'm not sure.
And so he'd be in the hands of his three senior sergeants, wouldn't he?
Yeah, very much so. Plus the fact that we had a platoon sergeant who was in charge of the three sergeants.
Ah, now, I may have forgotten to ask about him. Mm. Who was he?
Sergeant Rayner, who finished up a captain.
Now, what was... No, we haven't mentioned him, I don't think. What was... Is it R-A-Y?
R-A-I, I think.
And what was he like?
Well, he was an ex-guardsman. I think he came to the Grenadier Guards. All soldier. Good administrator, because that was his job. Oh, he didn't have to know anything about machine guns. He had to ensure our ammunition was there and all the wants we had, you know, that was his job. He had to organise all that from behind the lines, and he was very efficient, you know. When we went back into reserve, he used to give us drill parades and used to sort of make it interesting, showing us some of the drills that the guards used to do and training us, you know, and giving us a bit of interest in that way. And I believe, as I said, he finished up as a captain. Well, I'm sure he did, because he's a great friend of John Denny's. And he visits John, and he goes to the regimental dinner every year, I believe, with John.
We'll check. But, again, a good sergeant.
Oh, yeah. We didn't...
Any others, though, that senior figures, or just individuals, characters that stand out in your memory?
Well, Tim Chatting was a great
you
character.
You mentioned him a bit, yeah.
Tim was a great character. I mean, he was the company sergeant major.
That's of C Company.
S Company.
And did he do well in action? Now, what was his role in action as well? Did you see much of him?
Well, he would chase all the people to keep... You see, the S Company comprised of the MMGs, the mortars, plus the anti-tank platoon that went over to Browning machine guns in Korea. So there were three big platoons, and because the assault pioneers, they were in that as well. And his job was obviously being CSM of all those people. All the sergeants would be obviously under him. And I think in his time in the army, Tim saw quite a bit of action, you know. But I'm not ever so sure of that, but I'm sure he did. Because he was, I think he's in his 90s now. So he was probably in the back end of the war.
And he did a good job.
Oh, yeah, he was... everyone liked him. Everyone was frightened of him, everyone used to laugh at him, you know. He was a great bloke, really, yeah. Unfortunately, poor old Tim had an impediment. He used to stutter a bit, you know. So people, unfortunately, used to take him off a bit, you know. Because when you met him and he started to stutter, you know, you didn't want to laugh at him, but you wanted to laugh because somebody else had been taking him off, you know. But, I've got to say, he wasn't in any way inefficient. Mm-hmm.